Ever felt like nothing is going right? Well, cheer up and welcome to DAVE, the Caregiver's Caregiver Radio Program on Health Star Worldwide, where you'll learn how to avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout and how to survive the grieving process. They say that there are only three types of people in the world: those who are caregivers, those who will become caregivers, and those who will someday need a caregiver. Join Dave and his guests now and every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific on Health Star Worldwide as they share practice tips and tools that you can start using immediately to help get you through this day so you can live your caregiver life more fully and abundantly. Now, here's your caregiver host, Dave Nassani.
From Los Angeles, a big LA welcome to all my listeners out there in Radio Land. I am Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver, coming to you live globally for the famous Health Star Worldwide Network. Yes, folks, I'm the guy who's going to help you and guide you through this very difficult journey called caregiving. And we're going to do our very best to help you avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout. Such a nasty thing. You don't want to have that. And we're going to help you avoid that. And we have an exciting show planned for you today with my very late co-host, Adrienne Gruberg. She's not here yet, but we're expecting her. Founder of the Caregiver Space. Our guest, Curtis L. Walker, will be with us today talking about his new book, The Courageous Caregiver. So stay tuned. You do not want to miss this show. Now, if you're new to the show, and we get many new listeners every week, especially from the Blab Television Network, I'm your host, Dave Nassani, and this show is to caregivers of every kind. And the one thing we know about caregivers is that they are caring, selfless, sacrificial. Oh, yeah, they have this bad habit that they're very prone to burnout because they tend to put everyone else's needs above their own. Folks, come on, learn a lesson from the airlines. There's one thing you can learn from them that, you know, when they tell you to, in the event of an emergency and the oxygen mask falls out of the ceiling, that before you helped your loved ones with their mask, put your mask on first. Because they know from experience that if you don't, you will most likely black out and you won't be any good to anybody with anything. So caregivers are kind of exactly the same way. Now, we also talk about grief and loss here and the devastating effects that it can have on us. It automatically throws us into this other thing called the grief process. Another ouch. Unfortunately, folks, there's only one way out of the grief process, and that's to go through the grief process. You can't go around it, can't go over it, can't go under it. You got to go through it. And hopefully we can help you through your grief and your loss if you happen to feel like you're stuck. Hey, I want to thank my last week's guest, caregiver and famous author Harriet Tramer. You can hear that interview on podcast. Just find the link on my website, caregiverscaregiver.com. And wow, the Adrienne has come in. Welcome, Adrienne.
I've been waiting for you to see that I was here.
Well, I was reading my script, so I was kind of distracted. Sorry. All right, enough of that. Let's get going with Curtis and Adrienne. Adrienne, welcome to the show. Curtis, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for agreeing to this interview today. I really appreciate it. And Curtis, why don't you just take a minute or two and tell us a little bit about yourself. Who is Curtis? And I apologize that he can't be on Blab with us. We tried really hard yesterday, but just too many technical difficulties. So he's on the phone.
Right. Yeah, I know we had a lot of difficulties trying to put all this together. When we were trying to put it together, this thing is designed for a PC world, and I work on a Mac. So what's up with us is getting there. But we finally worked it out doing the call. But just to give you a little feedback about myself, my name's Curtis Walker. I'm a new writer. I just produced this book back in January. And this book was a work of, I'm going to say, a lot of pain and toil that went into developing it. This book came from a lot of journaling that I had to do when I was involved with some heavy caregiving dealing with my sister. My sister had contracted Lewy body dementia. As far as for my care process, really started about probably 6 years ago. She actually had it a lot longer than that, but my personal care was really about 6 years. But as far as for my background, even before getting involved with care, I'm former military, and I'm a pretty by the order, by the book kind of a person, regimented. And to be thrusted in the position of being a caregiver, it was a huge stretch for me.
Really?
You see, I'm like, you know, I'm either having orders barked at me or I'm barking orders at other people to get things done. Now, as a caregiver, especially with someone with dementia, that was, I'm going to say that's a heavy thing for them to deal with. And then to actually watch the response that comes out of that. That was a hard adjustment for me to actually understand as far as the reactions that she gave or when she actually heard me speak or whatever else. So I had to do some adjustments in my tone, the way I spoke. But I'm going to say continuing more so about myself. And I said that part about the military to let you know I was outside of my element as a caregiver. I'm the youngest of, I have five older sisters and a brother, but my sister, her name is Annette Walker. She was my, I'm going to say she fell in the middle of the crowd of all my other sisters. And when it came time to actually have care taken place, she insisted that I be the one to take care of her. I
really?
Have no idea why she chose to do that, but.
Were you close before, more than the others?
Oh, well, no, I would say early on, no, we were not close. We were, I'm going to say, as younger siblings, we fought like normal siblings. And even that ranged all the way up into our teens and 20s. And there was a period of time where we didn't even talk that much. But then when the care process actually got started, I was resistant to it, even though she knew she wanted me to do it. So when I got involved with doing it, you know, I fought it tooth and nail, but I had to give in because I saw how bad her situation really was.
Wow, you're a man of compassion, huh? More so than the other siblings. Usually in a family, isn't this right, Adrian? There's always one sibling that rises to the occasion and the other's saying, oh, you know, that's not my calling and good luck with you. I'll send you some money or whatever, right?
Always one is usually the sister. Why do you think she picked you above your siblings?
I'm going to say, well, all my siblings, they're all older than me, and they all had their own different lifestyle and things that were going on. And she knew that as far as I was concerned, I was very orderly and can actually get things done. And in her case, she had a lot of stuff that needed to get addressed. Her finances were in severe disarray when I got involved. And I mean, she had serious tax issues that I had to figure out and try to work through. And, there are some medical issues that had to be worked through. Now, when I did the caregiving, I did it along with my sister's oldest daughter. And we kind of, well, in a way partnered, but I led the whole caregiving process. So
You had never been a caregiver before, right?
No.
So where were you getting all of this wisdom and knowledge and leadership from that you just kind of took control?
Well, I'm going to say it got to the point where when I started out, I was getting severely stressed and overwhelmed. I didn't even know what dementia really was. And when I first heard about it, it was even hard for me to take it serious because I didn't believe at first that she had it. Because my sister was a very vibrant person. She had her own business. She went all over the place. She was engaged in all different types of things. She actually was a minister, too.
Wow.
And it was hard for me to see her for her former self and then to actually be the person that I ended up having to care for. I mean, it was a night and day amazing kind of thing for me to witness. And I had to, come to terms with what I was facing. I was in denial about it.
So the finances being messed up and the taxes, that would be unusual behavior for her, huh?
It was, really, really bad. I mean, it was thousands of dollars in back taxes at the IRS that she owed. And I had to do a lot of work to try to go through all her records. And what I was finding out was, in her mind, she thought she was filing her taxes when she never did. I found tons and tons of tax records and tax filing that had never been submitted. But the IRS was coming after her, claiming she owed tons and tons of money, which she never even made as much money as they claimed that she owed. So there were a lot of legal issues I had to fight through.
Adrian, have you ever heard of Louise? How do you pronounce it again?
I don't know enough about Louis, buddy. I was going to ask Curtis if he could explain the difference between Lewy body dementia and dementia and Alzheimer's.
Good question.
Well, you think of dementia, first of all, look at it as though dementia is a giant umbrella. And under the umbrella, you're going to have different dementia. Alzheimer's is a form of dementia. Lewy bodies is a form of dementia. Huntington's disease and Parkinson's disease, those are all forms of dementia.
Okay.
What Lewy body does is, like, pretty much when it comes for all forms of dementia, it has some sort of memory impairment. So my sister showed the classic signs of forgetting names, dates, places. She forgot where she was sometimes when she traveled places.
Mm-hmm.
Or when she drove, she would call and say, you know, I'm lost. How do I get back home? Mm-hmm. You know, and so with that situation coming into play, that's kind of drove me to get deeper into the care part. But the actual Lewy body part, to distinguish it from the other forms of dementia, that sets off the deterioration in the brain sets off a trigger that tells your muscles in your body, especially your major muscles group, to tighten up and restrict or constrict.
Uh-huh.
So it became where she was like curled up in a ball a lot. Or she walked hunched over because her muscles in her back was always tight. So during at least the last year of her life, she spent that almost entirely bedridden.
Wow. Yeah. Thanks for explaining that to me. I really didn't know. That's
how many different types of dementia are there, and what percentage of the population gets that one?
There are about 80 different types of dementia. As far as for the population that gets Lewy bodies, I really wouldn't say. I'm hearing a lot more and more about it, though.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that is amazing.
I do know that it's a very intense level of dementia. It's like pretty much the toughest a person could actually face when it comes to not just the memory loss, but the effects that it does on the body.
So how did you handle the emotional stress? I mean, how did you ever suffer the burnout? I mean, how long did it take you to get, you know, to the point where you said, okay, I got this? You know? Well, or maybe you're still not there. I don't know.
I'm going to say during the later stages of her life, I had it pretty much down to what I was doing. But prior to that, I'm going to say within the first year of taking care of her, she had me at my wit's end to the point where I was ready to just give up and walk away.
Hmm. That sounds like burnout.
I was there, and it was to the point where it was causing me problems on my job that I had. I was stressed out because I was actually cutting deep into my own personal finances to try to help take care of her. And I'm going to say, you know, at the emotional level, I was working. Well, I have I had a life of my own. I'm married. I have two kids. My kids were going, both graduating from high school during the early stages of her care. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to help get them in college. And it was a lot of hassles already on my shoulder just from that. And then to throw on the care for her, and that was gigantic. So as far as for getting help, one of the main things that kind of pushed me in the right direction was I knew I had to work. So in order for me to work, I had to get help with her. So I ended up getting her into this adult daycare facility that's in my local area here in Auburn Hills.
Uh-huh.
And the lady who managed that facility, she was phenomenal. I mean, she loved my sister as though she was her own sister, or even, I'm going to say, like an older child of her. And she, you know, she would watch over my sister, and she would, you know, I would take her in. She would, I mean, just make sure my sister had a wonderful time. Now, when I first started my sister in daycare, she resisted that whole idea. So that was the first biggest hurdle I got, had to go through. But the lady who ran the facility, her name is Jackie Smyrna. But once Jackie got a hold of my sister just fell in love with her, and they were like a pair in a sense. So that made my life a whole lot easier. But now Jackie took it another step further, where she pushed and insisted that I go through counseling myself. She pushed and insisted that I get plugged in with the Alzheimer's Association.
Did that help?
The smart lady.
Oh, the Alzheimer's Association they are a large organization, and they help quite a bit. I know in my area they have like support groups all over. So I got myself plugged into one of the support groups, and I got to hear stories of other people who are going through the same thing that I was going through.
How did those stories of others help you? Because so many people still aren't taking advantage of caregiver support groups out there. And, you know, I don't know what else we can do. You know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink it. Maybe you can convince a few more that they need to consider support groups again. Go ahead and do your best.
Okay, well, I know I consider myself a pretty smart person. I've been to college. I have an IT degree. I work on computers a lot.
You look pretty smart. We're looking at your picture here.
Yeah.
Don't look at that thing, because I have a face for radio. So, you know, if you deal with that face without throwing up, you're pretty good. But I mean, as far as for the support groups, one of the things that I had to get past was thinking that I knew everything. I read a lot of books. I did a lot of studying on the disease and all that. And there are a lot of books that talk about the effects of the disease. There are not enough books to talk about the emotional effects that a person goes through when you are caring for someone. And there are some things that I did not see that I was doing that was detrimental to my own health.
Give us an example.
I give you an example. Sleep. I was so wound up and peed off about her that I couldn't sleep straight. I mean, I would probably average 3, maybe 4 hours of sleep a night because my mind was wound up about what she was doing or what she was going to get into. Or I would get a phone call about something that she's into or whatever. And so, you know, that kept me keyed up. So the lack of sleep was also generating a lot of stress.
And what are some of the symptoms of your sleep deprivation that you were experiencing?
Some of the symptoms?
Yeah. From not getting enough sleep?
Oh, there was physical fatigue where I was tired. When I'm on my job, I'm sitting at my desk and just falling asleep. Sometimes even while driving, I would tend to doze off. And, you know, that's highly dangerous right there.
you think?
It's severe. And the other part related to the fatigue was when I got, I'm going to say really fatigued, I was easily agitated. It didn't take much to set me off to the point where I could potentially start yelling at someone, and even somebody who was innocent that was not even related to the reason why I was yelling.
Right.
And, you know, it would just creep up on me and take me by surprise.
Yeah. Now,
you know,
classic signs of burnout.
Right. And other things that I experienced that I was doing, I was physically wearing myself out, because with my sister being in her condition, I had to be more physically engaged with moving her around. So there was a point in time where it literally threw my back out to the point where I couldn't walk for a couple days. So then I had to get help and assistance with dealing with my sister, because, you know, the pain was just so much for me that, you know, I couldn't even think straight.
Yeah. Well, listen, let's take a break, and we'll continue this when we get back. I want to talk more about, you know, some of your symptoms that you were experiencing, and then we'll get into your book and tell us what that's all about. So don't go away. We'll be right back in a couple of minutes.
Caregivers, have you ever felt like nothing is going right? Well, cheer up and tune in today, the Caregivers Caregiver Radio Program on HealthStar Worldwide, where you'll learn how to avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout and how to survive the grieving process. With roughly 100 million caregivers in the U.S. and Canada alone, it's about one-third of the population.
That means everybody probably knows somebody caring for a loved one. They say that there are only three types of people in the world: those who are caregivers, those who will become caregivers, and those who will someday need a caregiver. Mothers of special needs children, family members caring for elderly parents, spouses, siblings, or friends caring for disabilities such as Alzheimer's, dementia, cancer, stroke, heart disease, diabetes, muscular dystrophy, AIDS, autoimmune diseases. The list goes on. Join Dave and his guests every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific on HealthStar Worldwide as they discuss avoiding caregiver burnout and surviving grief. You'll start feeling better in no time as you begin to receive practical tips and tools that you can start using immediately to help you get through the day and to live life more fully and abundantly.
And we're back with Curtis Walker, and he's going to be telling us about his experiences and the book he wrote and why he wrote it and all of that. So, Curtis, what other symptoms did you have, and how did the support groups really help you?
Well, I mean, other symptoms that I dealt with, I talked about the stress a lot, but depression also was the thing that plagued me. Now, everybody actually, when I went through the support group, one thing I understood was that everybody deals with a certain level of depression. It's just that it's the method of how you choose to deal with it will determine on how effective or no, how damaging depression can be to your lifestyle. So one of the things that the support groups taught me about was being a lot more conscious about what you're thinking on a day-to-day basis. Because with the disease has its limitation on its course on what it's going to do to the physical body. You know, there's nothing you can really do about that. Those are just, you know, standard events or things that are tied in with that disease. But I had to become conscious and aware of how I thought about those particular events as they were being played out. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like, for instance, when my sister was in pain, it did hurt me to watch her in pain and anguish, but I knew that I had to step in and address it, but I had to also be sensible about how I was going to address it, where I wasn't going to let this disease break or deteriorate the relationship that I had been developing with my sister. Mm. There were a lot of times where, you know, she would be in pain and she would sit and rock and I would just sit there and hold her hand. I had to learn a lot of effective tools with helping with her emotional state and also addressing some of her physical concerns, as far as, you know, like medication, therapy. We had physical therapists that would come to the house and kind of assist her with some of the things that she was going through. But I had to really just learn a lot about myself and how I thought about the disease and also thought about myself as a caregiver. I kept playing the victim role right off the bat. I kept asking myself, why me? Why did all this end up happening to me? And also, why did this happen to my sister? She was in the prime of her life. She was starting her business. She had a real estate business. And she also had, she made dresses and she ran fashion shows. And she was, you know, just busy and thriving with her life. And all of a sudden, it's all gone. And I was thinking, as intelligent as my sister was, how is it that now she has a mind that can barely put two and two together? And that was hard for me to watch. But one thing that did not change for her as far as, you know, her mind changing was her loving spirit. There were moments where the disease caused her to get wound up and agitated, and she would lash out. And I understood after a while that it was because there was some need that wasn't being met.
Yeah.
Once I got past that, I then was able to see that she had a very strong, loving nature. During the later stages of the disease, you know, this is pretty common with people who have Alzheimer's or dementia, where they will lose the memory of their loved one. As far as not forgetting, they would forget the names or whatever else or who this person was. And she got to the point where she forgot who I was. But one thing I understood was she did not forget what I represented to her. Like in her later stages of her love, the last year, she developed this issue with the disease where it caused for her to lose her eyesight. Mm.
Really?
She really couldn't tell who was around her, but she could feel and sense who was around her. So magic. Every time, and I was with her every day, and when I was near her, she could sense it. And I could always watch the continence on her face and on her body, and she would get a lot more relaxed whenever I was near. Mm-hmm. But I also noticed when other people who weren't regularly around her who were present, she would get really intense, tighten up.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was kind of almost locked to taking care of her and keeping her calm.
So when did you start to get the idea that you needed to share this story, you needed to write the book? And have you ever written a book before? I mean, did you do it by yourself? Did you self-publish it? I mean, tell us about that journey that you've been on.
But that was an interesting journey. The book started off as a series of journals that I was keeping. That was one of the things that I was encouraged to do to cope with some of my feelings that I was experiencing. And so, like, during the last year of her life, I had to check her into a nursing home. And so every day I'm with her at the nursing home, I would go in and I would feed her, get her, make sure her bedding was changed and all that. Then I would just sit there with her for a while. She couldn't speak. She couldn't do much. All she could kind of do was just sit there. So I just spent time, and I would sit in a chair and I would write. I would write in my journal. I would write about her. I would write everything I could possibly remember about her, because she had no memory. She had no way of telling her story. So actually what I did was, the first thing that I wrote was I wrote a paper kind of cataloging her life in summary. And I posted it over her bed, because one of the things that I noticed while being in the nursing home is that I saw a lot of people in the nursing home who did not get visitors. And as a result of that, they had minimal attention from the staff in the nursing home. And they were treated just as normal patients. So I wrote this letter, in a sense, to kind of let all the people in the nursing home know who my sister was and to know what she represented to this world.
That was smart.
So each one, they would go in and they would read it. And some people would start sobbing after they read it. And, you know, they said, "You did a wonderful thing with this writing." And I was like, you know, I didn't do it for the accolades of it. I just did it to treat her like human beings. But then after about probably a good 6 months more writing, I mean, I had pages and pages upon stuff that I journaled. I then started saying, you know, maybe I could take this information and share it with somebody, because a lot of the stuff I was writing wasn't just about her story, but it was our journey of what her and I had to go through. This book is talking about some specific things related to her, but it also talks about the growth that I had to go through as a caregiver. And then it talked about some of the struggles that a standard caregiver would have to face and experience, some of the mental struggles that you would have, that you would normally take. For me, it was hard to understand this disease and the effects and the ranges of where it was going to take someone. So I had to do a lot of homework on that. So I had to do some deeper research. And every time I researched, I took that information and I had to move from writing it from pen and paper to actually writing it on my computer. So then, you know, page after page, I started putting so much detail in it. I mean, I wrote everything ranging from dealing with, you know, emotional issues, outbursts that you would experience with a caregiver, how to calm them down when things get worked up. I wrote on issues related to legal matters, because I found that being a caregiver, if you don't have your ducks in a row legally, you will have a lot of roadblocks from everybody that you'd have to deal with, whether it's at the medical level or dealing with financial matters. But if you don't have like a power of attorney or guardianship or conservatorship put in place properly, you're going to have a lot of headaches for yourself. So
what did you do for a living beforehand? You seemed so organized.
What did I do after I got out of the military? I started working for a company called EDS. They're no longer around, but that company was put together by Ross Perot, and they did a lot of IT services for General Motors. Mm-hmm. So I did that for, you know, quite some time. And then I've been working in the IT field probably, I'm going to say, 25 years or more.
Yeah. I'm sure Adrian can relate to everything you're doing because she's got journals and she's in the process of turning those journals into a book now. Did you want to say something, Adrian?
Well, I want to, do you think your book is something for caregivers that would help them, or is it specifically any caregiver, or is it specifically for people who are dealing with Lewy body and dementia and Alzheimer's? Because there are unique problems, and then there are problems that all caregivers share no matter what they're doing, who they're caring. Right.
Yeah, there's some commonalities as far as what all caregivers would experience when it comes to various things within this care. Now, there's a segment in there specifically dealing with people with memory issues and dealing with Lewy bodies. So I had to write a segment in there understanding what this disease was, and especially when it comes to getting a good diagnosis. One of the things I did understand is if you don't get a good diagnosis up front, then you could end up getting the wrong medicine that could actually accelerate the disease. So that's why it was important to make sure that, like me as a caregiver, I had to learn how to partner with my sister to get her to cooperate with getting the right care she needed from the medical staff so that we could get appropriate medicine. But as far as for how this book fits into the other areas related to care, I mean, it covers, you know, everything as far as for you as a caregiver first stepping on the scene as being a caregiver, some of the emotional things you experience, all the way to the physical level as far as for, you know, organizing your day, physical activity. Like, let's say if they're bedridden, information on, you know, how to move or transport somebody. It covers information there as far as medication. Then I know that as far as for with dementia, there's forms of it that's also, they haven't quite nailed it down yet, but there's portions of it that could be hereditary. There's a potential there. So as a caregiver, there's certain things that we need to do as far as preventive maintenance. So I put a lot of information in there about that, because in my family, there are at least three other people who have this disease.
Wow.
So I had to become heightened aware about it. And then, like, you know, what Dave said with early on with him getting tested himself, you know, this is something that I really work on challenging my memory too as a form of a test.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really big on getting checkups. Before, I hated doing checkups. Now,
how old are you now?
I'm 50. I just turned 50.
All right.
Yep. So, and those checkups are important. They're vital to ensure the integrity of my own health so that I can be helpful to other people down the road.
So what are you doing for yourself? Like crossword puzzles? How are you challenging your brain?
One thing that I do, I try to introduce myself to as many strangers as possible and remember their names.
Remember their names, yes.
Mm-hmm. I try to go to different places and remember names as much as possible, or remember details about people. So, you know, that for me, that was always a hard one. The other thing that I'm doing right now is trying to learn a foreign language. Because you have to challenge your brain to always learn new stuff, because our brains are what you might call a very efficient, it's a very efficient system, but it likes simplicity. So, like, if you are, in my case, I've done IT for quite some time. There's some things I could do quite naturally, but I could do it without my brain being fully engaged. And actually, that's one of the ways dementia could sneak up on an individual. If you're so routine that you're doing stuff out of reflexes and you're not challenging new things that you're learning, you can't really tell if you are having any short-term memory issues.
Mm-hmm. It would be as simple as driving. So many times I'm driving somewhere and, you know, it's such a routine, a rep through a maze. A lot of times, and this is scary, I don't remember how I got there. I was just like, oh, my God. So they say you should take different paths. You know, if you always go to work the same way, go a different way. You know, and just even something as simple as that would break it up.
Oh, absolutely. The other thing that I've been doing for myself is there's this study that's going on around called neurobics. And what aerobics does is when you look at your five senses, you know, your sight, your smell, your touch, and everything else, they have a standard way of receiving information and transferring it to the brain. Well, what you're doing is you're kind of looking at other senses to tell you the same information, just in a different way. One test of aerobics would be, like, let's say you walk to your house and you go to your front door. Most people have a routine of what they would do when you walk in your house. You would probably go in, take off your coat, put your keys down, and then you'd probably go in, flip on the TV, or you go check your mail or whatever else. One test for with aerobics would be you go in and you do the whole entire exercise with your eyes closed. You try to do it as, you know, as long as possible and try to be as exact in what you would do with your eyes closed. And that forces you to engage all your other senses. And what that's doing is it's building additional neural pathways to the same source of information.
Are there any chapters in your book about this stuff?
This is something I just discovered as I completed my book.
Well, now you got for the second book.
How did exactly. you discover it?
Go ahead, Adrian.
Question.
I wanted to know how you discovered it. Where was the information that you discovered?
Well, I got that information from going online, doing a lot more research. I came across this book. It's called Keep Your Brain Alive. And it's written by a Dr. Lawrence Katz, and let's see. And then there's another book that I've been studying, and that one is called 2 Weeks to a Younger Brain by Dr. Gary Small.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah,
we need that.
Put a resource link out here so it can help people.
That'd be a great book title for you on your next book.
Oh, definitely. So, yeah, I've been, I know as far as late, what I've been doing with as far as promoting the book, because I got help from the different groups from the Alzheimer's Association, I now give back. So I travel to the different support groups in my metropolitan area. And I go and I share my background, my story, and my wisdom, and I try to give insight and feedback to kind of help people through their journey. Because the whole purpose of this book is that people don't have to suffer at the same level that I suffered when I was blindsided by this whole disease. I mean, statistically, the way we're looking at it right now, there's a gigantic epidemic that's going to sweep this entire globe.
Yep.
I mean, right now we're looking at one out of every five families, they have to deal with somebody with dementia. And that's a little over 7 million people right here in the U.S. Now, within the next 9 to 10 years, you're looking at that number to dramatically shift to one out of every two families.
Wow, really?
We're going to have to care for somebody with dementia. There's a shortage of nursing homes. Mm. Some people won't even have the option of being able to put people in nursing homes, so you're going to have to do at-home care, and you have to equip yourself with the right tools to do this. Now, the danger is, I know, like with me, as a caregiver, and this is what I see happening in with a lot of couples who are caregivers. They love their mate so much that they will do anything and everything and go to the point where they will almost kill their own selves. Yep. With the level of care that they're doing, and they won't stop, you know, and I've seen it time and time again. And I, you know, I try to counsel and advise people that one of the things that on my website, I put it's called CourageousCaregiver.org. I put training videos and try to coach and teach people. Next series that I'm working on is helping people to develop a team mentality when it comes to caring. You know, you as a caregiver, you might be the primary caregiver, but you have to develop a whole series of people and assistants to help you get the job done. Because there are no badges, there are no awards, there are no special ceremony for all the stuff that you end up doing as a caregiver.
Yeah.
And actually, as a caregiver, I come from a huge, large family. And when I started caring for my sister, I had a lot of family members right off the bat saying, oh, I'm going to be there. I'm going to help you. I'm going to, you know, I'll be there. You call me. I'm coming. I'm going
to
be there.
Yeah, we've all heard that before. Hey, listen, I hate to cut you off, but we need to take another break. Hold that thought, and we'll be right back in a couple of minutes. Don't go away.
One arm, one leg, 100 words. Overcoming unbelievable hardships is a touching story about Charlene, a stroke survivor. Back in 1996, Charlene was a healthy, normal, very active 52-year-old woman whose amazing talents resembled that of both a Martha Stewart and Wonder Woman. But all that changed when she suffered a massive stroke that left her severely speech impaired and paralyzed on her right side. She met her husband, Dave, 21 years earlier. They had a wonderful, fairy tale, storybook-like courtship that soon culminated in their marriage. Charlene had just come out of a marriage where after 10 years, she received two black eyes and a broken nose by her former husband when he came home high on speed. Charlene believed in no second chances of any kind for abuse, so she left. Finding herself all alone in the world with her 5 and 10-year-old daughters, Cynthia Lorraine and Deborah Lynn, she started raising them by herself for the next 2 years. Then fate brought them all together. After falling in love with Charlene, Cindy, and Debbie, their love then produced Rebecca. They all had a wonderful, normal life for the next 20 years. But today, things are very different for everyone. One arm, one leg, 100 words. Overcoming unbelievable hardships is the amazing story of a woman's fight to survive all that life had thrown her way. Everyone who knows Charlene is thoroughly amazed at how she lives day by day, month by month, year by year, and with a smile on her face and hope in her heart that everything is going to be okay. Her faith in God is her foundation in this hope that everything happens for a reason and what doesn't kill her will make her stronger. She inspires everyone that meets her. Best-selling author Lynn Barrington says, if you think you have it bad, read this book. This is a beautiful, genuine story from the heart. It is inspiring and easy to read. When you finish this book, you'll be able to look at your concerns in a new light. 9-time Grammy and Dove Award recipient, the godfather of contemporary gospel music, Andre Crouch, says, Charlene just won't let the promises of God go, and she has not let her circumstances get in the way of her faith. She's not just a survivor, she's more than a conqueror. As the Bible states, you will be encouraged by her testimony, regardless of what you're going through. Order your copy today from the author's website, onearmoneleg100words.com. And Dave and Charlene will personally autograph your copy. Enjoy.
And we're back with Curtis Walker and Adrian Gruberg. Wow. Curtis, you're so knowledgeable. I'm just wondering if you've heard of... Well, Adrian, before I ask that, why don't you let me get the questions that you might have in your mind off your chest.
Well... The commercial sort of put me off. Wait, I need.
I know, me too.
Focus.
I can't remember my question.
Yeah. How old was your sister Curtis when she first showed signs that something was wrong?
She started actually seeing her doctor like in her early 50s, and when she started dealing with it, she kept it secret. She was very low key about it, and. I didn't find this out until like in her, I'm going to say around about 55, 56 or so when I got involved with it. And I actually went with her to her doctor's appointment. And it was a struggle for her to let me go to the doctor's appointment with her. Mm-hmm. But that's when the doctor kind of revealed to me that he's been talking to her for years about getting help. And she was very resistant to the whole idea. She was in denial that she even had the disease. So it was shocking for me to sit here and hear all that stuff. She got it real early, and she died at the age of 61 last year.
That's very young. Did she continue to work for those first few years before you went to the doctor with her?
That was the thing that actually brought it to a head. She tried to keep it secret. She tried to work, started making mistakes on her job. So as a result, her job initially was trying to cover it up. Not exactly cover it up, because they didn't even know it was a disease. They just thought she was having problems on her job.
Right.
They were giving her jobs with less responsibility. to the point where she couldn't even maintain the nose. And then her boss insisted that, you know, you need to go get a checkup to find out what's going on, and you can't return back to work until we see and know what's medically wrong with you.
Yeah.
And that's when she went to a neurologist, and then the neurologist, you know, said, you know, you are in a very bad state with this disease right now, and you need help. And that's kind of forced the issue for me to get involved with it.
How long did it take you to seek help for yourself, taking care of her?
I'm going to say after about the first year of me getting so stressed out to the point where I was losing my mind, that's when I said, okay, I need more help.
It better. Did you find any support groups online, or were they all face-to-face groups?
First, I started with reading. I mean, I went online and I read every little thing that I could find. I found, you know, different articles here and there just to understand the disease. But understanding the disease was not enough. I had to understand my place as a caregiver and the role that I had to play, because
exactly,
I'm not a doctor. I don't really know medical stuff. I mean, I know stuff now because of all my research I've done on it. But prior to the disease, there's no way I could do a medical analysis of how bad off she really was. So then that's when I had to shift the homework from her to myself. I had to learn how I was thinking. I had to learn my personality, how my personality was meshing with her personality while her memory was deteriorating over time. I had to learn about how to actually manage conflict, especially when you're managing conflict with somebody who is irate and realistically out of control, where, you know, you can, like, for a normal person, you can kind of stay calm down. With the person with dementia, that actually is like fuel to the fire that makes them flare up even more.
Yeah.
So I had to learn various techniques on helping her to calm down or put her in a calmer state. One of the things she would like to say is, I want to go home.
Right.
Now, going home, at first I thought it was physically taking her home. After a while, I really understood what home meant to her. Home wasn't the physical place. Home was the remembrance of what home felt like. Now, she, my sister, she loved to sew. She collected fabric all over the place. And we both, our mom, she was a professional cook. So my sister loved my mom's cooking. So what I figured out was, instead of trying to get her home, I would bring her home with remembrance of issues. I would then start thinking about, you know, I would remind her about how my mom used to make fried chicken, or my mom would make her biscuits, or she would make her turkey and dressing, or how my mom would was a mask. My mom used to sew too. So my mom would make all these various styles of clothing or whatnot. And after talking about that for a while, my sister would get distracted and calm down for the thing that agitated her. And then she would feel like she was home, even though she wasn't at home.
You were a really good caregiver.
Yeah. If I ever need one, can I call you?
Take care of yourself. And yeah, I have a website where we have support groups online. I could not go to a face-to-face group because I really needed to be on call in person 24/7. So committing to, I mean, there might be a couple of days where I could have gone, but to commit to 3 months of going to a support group just didn't seem fair to the other people in the group. So knowing that I could only deal with this on a on a computer became a very, very viable resource and a very valuable resource that I wanted to replicate for all caregivers, which is what we've been in the midst of doing all this time.
Well, that's the direction I'm actually headed, because after I developed the book, I developed my website. And on my website, I like to record videos and just tell my story, but also share ideas and techniques on how to do good quality caregiving. But then the next phase that I'm launching is to develop an actual web-based support group situation. I haven't put all the technical details together, but
good for you.
Works for me.
Good.
Adrienne is light years ahead of a lot of people, and she would be the perfect model.
Well, there are unique problems to creating support groups online. We've had lots and lots of people sign up for them, and yet they don't attend because they've been sidetracked, and then they get shamed. They self-shame and don't come to the group. So there's no shame in not being able to attend a group if you're a caregiver. I mean, there are a million reasons why not to. It's difficult to do successfully, and if at first you don't succeed, you just got to keep trying, which it sounds like you're capable of doing.
Well, we need to wind this up. Time is going so quickly. Why don't you tell us how people can get a hold of you or purchase your book? I understand it's on Amazon, and then we'll have Adrienne say how we can get a hold of her.
Oh, great. Well, I mean, to get a hold of me, I made it very simple. All you got to do is remember Courageous Caregiver and put the .org on the end of it. So it's CourageousCaregiver.org. And, you know, if you go there, you're going to, first of all, see links for the book. Their book is offered in Amazon. It's also offered in Kindle. But also, you're going to see a lot of free videos that I've been developing. It's my intent to get as much information out there as possible. So just remember, CourageousCaregiver.org. You can look that up on Amazon and easily get it. And if you have Amazon Unlimited, you actually can get it in free in Kindle.
What's the average length of your videos?
I usually try to keep the videos under 10 minutes. I do small snippets and segments, and it's driven by whatever questions that I get from other people.
That's great.
I would recommend also make 5 minutes snippets, because sometimes 10 minutes is just too much time for a caregiver to get away from there.
It's interesting.
Give them a choice.
7 minutes is the size
of magic number.
The magic number. For some reason, 7 minutes is the magic number.
Yeah,
no more than 7 minutes.
I started watching one of yours. I don't know how far I got, but I didn't get to the end because something came up. So 7 minutes. I think I could have lasted 7 minutes. No reflection on you.
Oh, no problem. I can get it down. It just have to break the
what I'm part talking. One, part two, part three, you know. Like a soap opera.
I just wanted to let you know how to get in touch with me. It's Adrienne, Adrienne, at thecaregiverspace.org. Again, it's thecaregiverspace.org. And the site's amazing.
Yeah, she has almost 150,000 followers so far. Wow. I'm speechless. But thank you again to my listening audience. Thank you to Adrienne and Curtis for coming on the show. Don't forget, we're here every noon, every Tuesday at noon. You're okay. And don't forget that all our shows are recorded podcasts, so you can listen on the same HealthStar Worldwide Network link anytime. We're actually on 9 different platforms, and I can't even remember the 9 of them. I should have them in front of me. I know that, you know, iTunes, YouTube, they're all on my website, caregiverscaregiver.com. And under the Uplifting Interviews tab, I think we've got iTunes, we've got Stitcher, we got, it doesn't matter. I'm continuing to post them on Blog Talk Radio as well. So just a reminder, when you're on my site, don't forget to go to the link that says, are you a candidate for burnout? Because we want to assess where you are in the burnout process. And if just for doing that short quiz, we will give you a free copy of my book, One Arm, One Leg, 100 Words, Overcoming Unbelievable Hardships and Incredible Value. Why? Just because I'm a nice guy. So until next week, may God richly bless you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Caregivers Caregiver Radio Program with Dave Nassani. Join Dave each Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific, or catch the program anytime, 24/7, right here on HealthStar Worldwide.